Hi, everyone. I am Tressa Grauer. I'm the Vice President for Thriving Communities at Reconstructing Judaism. I want to welcome you here today. I want to acknowledge that there is a lot of pain in this moment, and we are all having the somewhat surreal experience of toggling between the news and all the feelings that that raises up in us and the day-to-day practicalities of our work and personal lives. I understand that is what we are all grappling with in some way. As Nina wrote in the invitation to this meeting, we contemplated postponing this call because of the war, but ultimately decided to go ahead with it, knowing that it is always our kavanah, our intention to do what we can to support our communities, and this is one very important way to think about strengthening our communities. Our experience this week has really been about how important it is to be in community. And so I want to just say at the outset that I am very grateful to be in community with all of you. And with that, I am going to turn the floor over to my colleague, Nina Corrigan, to introduce today's speaker.
Hi, welcome everyone. It's good to be with you all. And I am very delighted to welcome our speaker today, Mark Nussbaum. And Mark is a certified financial planner with many years of experience. He's a member of the Reconstructionist Congregation Dor Hadash in San Diego, where he's a trustee on the endowment board, and he's a longtime member of the Reconstructing Judaism board. Mark is passionate about planned giving and securing the future of Jewish community institutions, and I feel very fortunate to have him with us today. He is going to talk more about his background, which is I am keeping my introduction brief. And so I will turn it over to Mark. If you have questions during the presentation and want to put or how need help technically, please put it in the chat to me and I will do my very best to help you.
Great, thank you, Nina. As Nina said, I'm Mark Nussbaum, and I'm talking to you here from La Jolla, California, outside San Diego. For the past 17 years, I've been a member of the Board of Governors of Reconstructing Judaism, and I'm the chair of the Investment Committee for the past 12 years. Our primary responsibility on the Investment Committee is to oversee the $15 million endowment fund for the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College. Now, as presidents, treasurers, congregation administrators, and congregational leaders, I want to thank you all for taking the time today to listen and learn about planned giving. Looking over the list, it looks like about eight communities already have an endowment, and eight communities have planned giving programs out of the 23 communities, 26 communities that are participating in this call. So we've got a good start. About a third of you are well on the way. But as Nina said, I'm passionate about this activity because I believe that I'm sharing with you something that can help you each individually make your mark on your community. Anyone who's been in a volunteer position knows how difficult and somehow at times how thankless that job is. I've often compared being in a position of responsibility to being goalie on the javelin team. You are constantly receiving incoming spears from all quarters and complaints, challenges, et cetera. So I know how hard it is. I mean, you often feel like Smokey the Bear stamping out forest fires all around you. But I really believe that if you decide to move forward with a planned giving effort in your community or to revitalize or encourage one that's already existing, you personally can make a significant difference on the future of your community and assure that at the end of your term of service, whenever that may be, you'll be able to look back and know that you've made a significant difference in your community's future. And I can think of no bigger mitzvah that will benefit both you and your community than to assure your community's future. Now, as Nina said, I'm a longtime member of Congregation Dor Hadash in San Diego, and I've served in a number of leadership positions in our community, including being the major fundraiser, which means everybody runs from me when I try to say hi at services or community events, because I'm afraid I'm going to ask them for money. But in my day job, I'm a certified financial planner and a financial advisor. And about 18 years ago, we received a surprise bequest from one of our longtime committed community members, a retired teacher who passed away. She had not been a major donor, nor had she been a congregational leader or board member. She was mostly just an active participant who showed up regularly and volunteered from time to time. But she obviously loved and cared for our community, and she remembered us when she passed on. Now, in my job, I don't like talking about the word death because it always freaks people out. So I have a longtime client who says to me, it's much better if you talk about graduation. When I graduate to the next level, whatever the next level may be. So I prefer to use the euphemism graduate rather than talking about death and dying, because it's certainly a lot easier for everybody. In any case, when she passed on, she remembered us. And rather than use this generous gift to the congregation to forego the annual fundraising activities of our synagogue for a few years, the board chose to set aside these funds as the seed money for an endowment fund for our congregation. We were fortunate enough to work with our local Jewish Community Foundation, the JCF of San Diego, who were sponsoring an organizational training program called the Endowment Leadership Institute, ELI. And under the leadership of Gail Littman of blessed memory, the local federation and JCF wanted to encourage organizations in San Diego to train their lay and professional leaders to build endowments for the longer term viability of these Jewish institutions in San Diego. In exchange, I mean, their feeling was, why should all the money leave San Diego when they die and go back east to hospitals and universities and other places that why not keep it here in the community? So in exchange for grants from the Jewish Community Foundation, each of our organizations developed their own plan to establish and operate an endowment fund, as well as solicit our membership for current gifts, but more importantly, the promise of future gifts. The Jewish Community Foundation continues to encourage us by scheduling quarterly training sessions. And this year, offering another $5,000 grant for updating and then executing a new planned giving campaign. So we continue to work with them some 16, 17 years later on an ongoing basis. And they provided us with a tremendous amount of resources. They handle the investment of our funds. And over these past 18 years, our Congregation Dora Douse Endowment Fund has grown from the initial gift of $85,000 to about $250,000 today. Meanwhile, it's provided over $140,000 in funds that have been transferred from the endowment to our annual operating budgets over the past 16 years. The transfer amount this year is going to be about $12,000, which is about 5%, a little under 5% of the value of the endowment. And it covers about 5% of our operating budget, certainly more than we'd raise at one of our annual fundraisers, which requires so much volunteer time and effort that we don't have. We're a relatively small synagogue, just over 100 families. And we have more than 20 individuals and families that have either made a cash gift or request or indicated to us that they will leave us bequests as part of their estate plans. And we're now working on approaching the next group of members to solicit their interest in joining and expanding our legacy society. And so I want to encourage each of you to think about establishing a legacy society in your communities and recognizing the people who really, truly believe in the future of your congregation. It is my firmly held belief that the work on endowment building is absolutely critical to the future of Congregational Judaism in America. The program that was piloted here in San Diego and has been adopted and funded by Howard Grinspoon of the Grinspoon Foundation, he's funding the rollout of ELI programs nationwide. Your local community foundation or federation may already be involved with Harold and the Grinspoon Foundation, and they may be a source of resources for you to help get you going. So be sure and check with them, talk to them and see what's going on and see if they're involved. And if not, encourage them to get involved, because through federation or through your community foundation, Grinspoon will basically fund all the necessary resources. And our community has those resources. We have planned giving officers. We have a lot of resources that our communities in San Diego could tap into. But I believe that it's essential work, and it's why I agreed to speak with you today, the leaders of our synagogues, and encourage you to commit developing a plan for yourselves. I know that there are always issues that take priority due to the limited time and energy that volunteer congregational leadership and their boards have. but I want to encourage you to get started on this activity by naming a small committee to do the necessary legwork and get it going. So enough of the why. What is planned giving? Planned giving is just a fancy name for charitable gifts that are being solicited today, but not expected to be received until sometime in the future. Since they often involve gifts that are made when one graduates, passes on, we hope not to collect them until sometime in the very distant future. But we all know that time passes very quickly and things happen along the way. My oldest son is turning 40, which I cannot believe. Because I still dream about him and see him as a Cub Scout when he was 8 years old. But we also, time's going. And so it's important to get started on this work and to get going because you never know what's going to happen. That's why I want to raise this subject with you now, get you thinking about it. And I want you to in turn, raise this subject with some key people in your community to get them thinking on it as well. It's not for you as the president to do this activity. It's only for you as the president to hopefully energize and encourage others to get started on this activity. I mean, there's no way in this call this morning in a half an hour or so that I can make you a plan giving experts. And that is not my goal. I just really want to introduce this subject to you, give you a bit of an overview. I want you to understand why starting to have these conversations and making your community aware that you're having these conversations is important, because people will come forward, people that you're not even talking to, and will tell you that they have remembered the congregation in their will or estate plans, or will want to know more about how they can help the congregation longer term. So where to start? Let's start with what happens when you graduate. Nina, can you just put that slide up? That's a little, shows the circles with the three things.
Russell's gonna put up the slides for us.
Just put one slide up just for brief, so everybody can see. Oh, I guess we should have done that first, huh? Sorry.
It's all right.
Okay.
We've moved on.
Next one. No, keep going, next one. Nope, that's it, perfect. So this is what happens when you graduate or die. Most people that I've worked with as a financial advisor over the past 30 years do not want to talk about their own mortality. They don't want to think about it. They don't want to even broach the subject until they're absolutely forced to. And usually it's not the rabbi's sermon on Yom Kippur that gets them to think about it. It's rather the death of somebody close to them, either a friend or a relative or someone they know, or their spouse haranguing them in fear of what's going to happen if they disappear like mine does. And that gets the wheels turning and gets them to start thinking about their own mortality, their own legacies, and their own planning. By having conversations with some of your most committed members in your communities, you can jumpstart that conversation and give them the motivation to think about what their legacy could be, keeping your congregation and its programs going for future generations. So when you graduate, or move on, your assets, everything that you've accumulated over your lifetime, are going to go to one of these three places. They're going to go to your heirs that you designate, children, sisters and brothers, nieces and nephews, grandchildren. They're going to go to the charities that you designate, or they're going to go to the government, either the IRS or your state government, because many states have inheritance taxes. Now, you can decide how you want your assets to be split between these three groups. But to accomplish that, you need to have an estate plan of some sort in place. Now, if you don't have a plan or you postpone the planning for too long, you don't have to worry because you won't be here. The government will decide how your assets are to be distributed for you. And you can rest assured that their allocation will probably not correspond to yours, since they're going to take care of themselves first rather than your heirs and charity. So having an estate plan is important, as it will instruct whoever is responsible for disposing of what you've accumulated during your lifetime and what to do with all that stuff. All your assets get distributed in one of three ways. They're distributed by a contractual process, such as a beneficiary form for a retirement account or an insurance policy or an annuity. Or they're distributed by the legal instructions, such as the title of ownership, joint tenant with right of survivorship, tenants in common, community property, or by a trust document, or they are distributed by will, under will. Now, the distribution under will is a legal process that's overseen by the probate court in the state in which you're living when you pass. Most estate plans are designed to avoid probate. As in most states, the probate process is costly, with fees that are determined by the state and graduated based on asset values. Time consuming, because it takes a while to work through probate, many months to years, and it's public. Everyone knows what's going on. So as a result, many estate plans involve what's called a revocable or a living trust. And many of you have heard of that, but a revocable or living trust does not go through probate. A trust is just a legal entity that holds the assets for the trust beneficiaries while the donor, which is called the trustor, is alive, and then distributes them upon their demise per the instructions that the donor makes. The trust is amendable and changeable while the trustor is alive. Assets can be added or removed from the trust. The instructions can be changed. But upon one's graduation, one's death, the trust becomes irrevocable. And at that point, a new trustee of the trust is charged with following the instructions of the trust document for the distribution of the trust assets. In some cases, the assets may be distributed to various beneficiaries immediately. In other cases, the assets are held and invested in order to benefit different classes of beneficiaries over a longer period of time, such as a surviving spouse while he or she is alive, and then children or grandchildren. Trusts are especially essential in the event of a second marriage, where you've got children or heirs in the first marriage. We want to protect, and you also have a second spouse. But in any case, once you graduate, this trust becomes irrevocable. And the trustee who takes over the trust can either be an individual, a child, a friend, a spouse, or it can be an institution, a bank, a trust department, or a named fiduciary. Now, while the trustee, the donor, is alive, the trust will operate under the taxpayer ID and Social Security number of the donor, just as would any other way. But once the trust becomes irrevocable upon the death, a new taxpayer ID is issued to distinguish the trust from the individual, and it will continue to operate as long as the trust document instructs it to. No matter how simple your accumulated stuff may appear, everyone needs to have an estate plan. Even if it's a basic will that leaves everything to mom or dad or your spouse or your sister, everyone needs a plan. But as General George Patton famously said, most people don't plan to fail, they just fail to plan. And as I've told you already, if you haven't planned, the disposition of your assets will take place, it just may not conform to what you would have wished. Now, all the members of your community will either have an estate plan in place or they won't. And if they don't have one in place, they really should have one. And you can help them out by encouraging them to speak to an estate planning attorney about one. If there is one thing that the last few years of COVID should have shown all of us, is that the end can come quite suddenly and unexpectedly. So in the course of our conversation with a member about what they like about your community and what programming they would like to see continued for the future, it's appropriate to ask if they have an estate plan in place, and if not, encourage them to get one. Now, even if you have an estate plan, it needs to be updated periodically because the laws constantly change, as do your assets, as do your needs, as do your desires. And at a minimum, it should be reviewed by a professional at least once every 5 years, sooner if there are changes in either your state's inheritance tax law or the federal government's. But as part of an estate plan, it's relatively easy to remember an organization such as your congregation with either a direct cash gift or bequest. Because of the complexity of the tax laws, and income tax laws are different from estate and inheritance tax laws, there are some ways to make the gift that are more tax efficient or less tax efficient, and that's where an estate planning expert can really help. In addition to a simple cash bequest, one might decide to make the congregation the beneficiary of whatever is left over in a retirement account, either a 401k or an IRA. Many of our members have very modest means and are unsure what they're going to need in retirement or how long they're going to live. So they tend to be very conservative with their resources. And many older members of our congregations, we see that. They love the community, but they don't feel that they can be so generous with the uncertainties of their financial situation. But however, by encouraging them to leave what's left over to the congregation, they can assure that what was most important to them can continue on after they've gone. Now, another way to make a planned gift is by making the congregation a partial beneficiary on the sale of a residence. Many of our members do not have large extended families to support. As with our generous benefactor, we were a partial beneficiary of the proceeds from the sale of her house. Many of our members have condos, apartments, co-ops, or even second homes that they might want to leave part of to the congregation. Future gifts can be cash gifts or they can be gifts in kind. I have one client who's leaving his art collection to Yale University for their museum. Some of our members may have valuable paintings or pieces of art that they could leave to their congregation, not necessarily for display in the place of worship. Maybe they have a vehicle, a car, a truck, a camper, a motorhome. And by leaving it to the synagogue, it can be sold or liquidated with the proceeds benefiting the programs that they want to see continued after they've gone. Still another way to benefit the congregation is through a life insurance policy. Many people take out insurance early in their lives to provide resources in the event of an early demise. As they live longer, the need for those resources may disappear as the children are already educated, or the home mortgage has been paid off, or the other spouse has passed away already. And in that case, the congregation could become the beneficiary of a life insurance policy or an annuity that is providing the individual with income or assurances while they're still alive. Many individuals who are your strongest supporters and volunteers may not feel that they have enough resources to be generous with your community at this time. But they may find that once they graduate, there are assets that could become available to the community. And that's what we need to talk about. I said at the outset that my goal was not to turn you into planned giving experts. And I've already mentioned a couple of things that can be done. There's one other vehicle that you may hear about, and that's called the Charitable Remainder Trust, or a CRT. Now, a charitable remainder trust is a vehicle that permits an individual to make a gift to charity now and avoid capital gains taxes on a highly appreciated asset. Not only do they avoid the current taxes, but they get a significant current income tax deduction in exchange for a future income stream for some predetermined period of time, at the end of which whatever assets are left over in the trust are distributed to various charities at the instructions of the donor. The total value of the income tax deduction plus the stream of payments can often exceed the net value the donor would have received had they just outright sold the asset. And that's why these vehicles have increased in popularity over time. You'll learn more about them. Another gift that you might hear about is called a charitable gift annuity. You may get solicitations from your college or university to do one of these. A charitable gift annuity is similar to a charitable remainder trust in that you make a current gift to a not-for-profit organization and receive in return a stream of income payments for a predetermined period of time, either your life or your joint life with your spouse or a period certain 5, 10, 15, or 20 years, and you get a current income tax deduction. The charitable entity receives the gift up front, returns a portion of it to you over time, at the end of which it keeps whatever's left over. So for individuals who are concerned about their income, a charitable gift annuity may generate a much more attractive income stream than a bond or certificate of deposit with a bank. Even with rates rising, the returns, the payout ratios on a charitable gift annuity can be in the 8, 9, 10% level, which can be very attractive to people who are on a fixed income and are worried about covering their expenses. This can often make the donor feel more comfortable because they receive a larger stream of income now for their lives, even though they're giving up control of that certificate deposit or that bond or asset today. Now, these are just some of the plan giving tools. And again, I only want to make you aware of them so that if during the course of having these conversations about your community and its future with your members, you encounter some sort of objection. By knowing about plan giving, you can tell your potential donor that there are ways for them to accomplish two things at the same time. They can assure the future of your community as well as address their own financial needs. But to do that, they need an estate plan and they need to work with an estate planning professional. Where should you start? I think the best place to start is by identifying a short list of people in your community who you think might constitute the core of your committee. No more than three or four individuals at best. Together with you, and I suggest you begin to have meaningful conversations with certain key members of your community about how they see the future of your community. The people you should recruit or look to recruit might be financial people who are financial advisors or financial professionals, planners, estate planners, attorneys, but people who might be and people who are interested in the future of your community. Get them together, identify a short list of people you're going to talk to first, and then have one or two conversations to figure out what people might be interested in. The meaningful conversations are important, and we found the meaningful conversations really help the member reinvest in his community. We talk about what brought them to the community. What do they like about the community? What activities do they currently support? Do they attend? Do they love? Whether it's Torah study or Shabbat services or religious school or adult education. What activities would they like to see expanded? And we found that by asking people to explain sort of why they joined the community, why they like being a member, what they get out of attending and volunteering, you not only reinforce their investment in your community, but you open the doorway to encouraging them to visualize how they could assure that all that they love about your community can continue after they've gone. Why do this now? Well, we're just coming out of a dreadful 2 years dealing with COVID. And now more than ever, as Teresa said at the beginning, the core of your community understands how important the community truly is. The bonds of connection to a group of like-minded people who care about the same things that you do is really essential to our existence. So now's the time to have the conversation. Why are they a member of your community? What do they love about your community? What's been the best experience that they've had over the past 2 years? And what have they missed the most during COVID? There's nothing that people enjoy talking about more than themselves and what they care about. And so this is a really easy conversation to have. And once they've shared what they love about your community and what's most important to them, the next obvious question is, wouldn't you like to see this community continue forever? To be able to do that for others, to be able to do for others what it does for you and me, it's such an open-ended and easy question. And I can't imagine anyone saying no. And then you continue on. You can make that happen. Our community either has or is setting up an endowment fund. An endowment fund is an investment in our future that's designed to provide an income stream to our community in perpetuity. Perpetuity means forever. Think about that for a second. You can support your community forever. Not only while you're alive, but after you're gone, your community will continue, and the gift that you make will continue to support this community again and again and again. Now, many times, this is where you might encounter some pushback. Many people say, I don't have the resources to give today. I'm already supporting the community by giving XYZ. And it's instead of the response that you're looking for. The response you're looking for is, of course, how can I help? But again, this is your opportunity to remind the individual that you're not speaking about a current gift. This is not part of your annual fundraising appeal. This is not part of the building fund. This is about something in the future. And you hope it's going to be in the very distant future when they move on or graduate. But all of us will move on or graduate at some point. And what you're doing is you're asking them to think now about their legacy, how they want to be remembered in your community. What do you want people to say about them after they've gone? So briefly, what are endowment funds? Teresa, I think someone just put the slide up, but basically many of us are familiar with an endowment fund from our colleges and universities or our secondary schools or a local not-for-profit hospital or community activity, whether it's Planned Parenthood or anywhere else. They all have endowments. And an endowment is just a charitable entity created to hold financial assets on behalf of the organization permanently. These assets are invested to support both current operations and to grow over time to maintain purchasing power. And some communities already have endowments. Others have not even broached the subject. And I'd say it's not essential to have one to start the conversational process with your key members. There are many reasons why a donor might want to support the endowment. But the easiest reason is you saying, quote, we're not asking for a gift today. All we're asking for you is to consider our community in your estate plans. Once you finish with the estate plan question, I think the close of the conversation is relatively straightforward. Moisha or Esther, you have the ability to make sure that this community continues forever. By naming our synagogue or endowment fund as a beneficiary on your IRA or 401k, or by leaving us a bequest as part of your estate plan, you are making a gift that will help this organization in perpetuity. That means forever. And I think forever is a very powerful concept when you think about it and you think about your own personal legacy. Now, we all know from the prayer book that line, each of us is put on this earth for a limited time. What do we want to accomplish in our lives? And what do we want to be remembered for? What is our legacy going to be? These are difficult but important questions for each of us to ponder. And it doesn't hurt to ask that open-ended question of your member. And now I'm going to ask it of you as synagogue leaders and members. What do you want to be remembered for after you've moved on as president, administrator, treasurer? What do you want to be remembered for during your term of service in that community? Starting and getting your endowment fund and getting your legacy society started is a fantastic way to create your own legacy in the community. When you have a conversation with somebody who is a very committed member of your community about their legacy, you're enabling them to consider something that most of us may only think about on Yom Kippur when we practice dying. What are each of us going to be remembered for? And enabling a committed member of your community to leave a legacy is a gift that cannot be duplicated anywhere else. As with any fundraising venture, you're not asking them for yourself. You are asking on behalf of the community, and you both believe in, you want to make sure that it's sustained for future generations. So I hope I've motivated you to get the ball going in your community or get it restarted if it's already there. And now let me throw it open to questions. I probably talked long enough and made my pitch. So go ahead, Nina.
That was great. Thank you, Mark. Yes, so just raise your hand or put it in the chat. Haley, we'll start with you. You can go ahead and unmute.
Hi, thanks very much, Mark. That was great. I am curious to know whether congregations who are in process with this have an estate planning organization or some kind of financial planner that manages these assets for the congregation or helps manage the conversations with the members who are being asked so that there's somebody with that financial planning management capability on the outside of the congregation that helps facilitate.
So I here in San Diego, we have the Jewish Community Foundation of San Diego. They have a whole department. They have an estate giving officer. They have all the resources in-house. I spoke to them last week, knowing this was coming up. They do manage and deal with people who are not in San Diego County. However, they said that as a result of the Grinspoon Foundation and their grant in rolling out ELI nationwide, there may well be resources available through your Jewish community, local Jewish community foundation, or if you're fortunate enough to have a Jewish community or your federation. If you're fortunate enough to have a Jewish community foundation in your community, or you have a federation in your community, that would be the place to start to find out if the resources are there. They will most likely have a list. They will either have people on staff or they will have access to people who they worked with. Our community here in San Diego has developed a certified program where they actually get financial planners in my job in the community to become, you know, gifting professionals by going through their program and can be plugged in so they can refer people who come in to those people. But I also have a list of estate planning attorneys that I work with locally here. So potentially a financial advisor in your community may have estate planning attorneys that he or she works with. But I would start with the Jewish Community Foundation first. If there's nothing locally, you might contact the Grinspoon Foundation and find out, because they may be having conversations with people in your community already, or they may be looking to have conversations and can't find the right person, and you may be able to partner with them.
And just to follow on that question, if people already have estate plans and their own financial planners, that doesn't preclude them using their own financial planners
Absolutely not. People do their own things. I mean, I review someone else's work all the time and just ask the questions. I mean, it's just a second set of eyes. It's like going to a doctor for a second opinion. You can make sure that they get what they want out of it. The reason to talk to an estate planning attorney is that, unfortunately, the laws are state specific. There is a federal estate inheritance tax law, but the laws that govern activities are different state to state. When I moved to California from New York, I had to redo my entire state plan because California is a community property state. So even though I had done certain things in New York state, it didn't make sense in California and vice versa. So community property, non-community property states, the biggest difference, but there are also all kinds of other unique and personal things that happen. That's why you need an attorney to get involved. And there's also the whole issue of tax efficiency. Depending upon what you're trying to accomplish, there are more tax efficient ways to do it and less tax efficient ways. For instance, if you were going to make a bequest to the synagogue of $25,000, for instance, it would be much better for you to do it through your retirement account, through your IRA, by leaving a portion of your IRA retirement account to the congregation, because that is an asset that would normally be subject to federal income taxes. But by leaving it to the congregation, it is exempt from income taxes. Your heirs don't pay it. And therefore, you can distribute the same amount of money that you would by giving an heir, making an heir beneficiary in your IRA. You can gift them money from your taxable estate and be much better off. I.e., again, back to that pie chart, Uncle Sam gets less, your heirs and your charities get more. And I think that's all what we'd all love to see happen.
Great. Thanks for the question.
But it doesn't preclude you. One other thing you asked about management. So our Jewish Community Foundation manages the money. Our commitment to them by participating in the program is that we would give any bequests that come to us of $25,000 or more to them, and it's invested in one of their pooled funds. Now, our Jewish Community Foundation manages, I think at this point, $600 million for various organizations. But the ELI program has raised over $300 million in endowment gifts that they've tracked through this thing. So it's a very, very effective program. And it's not for the communities, it's not just the size of the gifts. It's really that by having these conversations, you really get your members invested in the community. They really feel more ownership, just as we've all found with building funds, and we ask money for building funds and other things. People who give money feel like they've invested in the community and have a stake in the community. And this is a great way to do it.
Great.
You're getting at people who are really your most committed members, not necessarily your wealthiest members.
Right. Right.
That's the key, because up until now, it's the person with the money is the big mocker. You know, the guy who writes the big check for, the Kol Nidre appeal, or has his or her name on the building or whatever else, gets all the attention. But this is a way where people with very modest means can have a very significant and long-term impact on their community.
Yeah. Yeah. Very true. John, do you want to unmute?
Yes, I am. I think I am unmuted, right? Okay, so we're not talking about that kind of money in our very small community. But what we have now is we have a number of named funds, one of which says that the amount of money in that fund cannot be allowed to go under a certain amount. I don't believe these are really endowments. And I just wondered how it interacts with an endowment fund.
Well, an endowment fund is a legal entity. So if you just create a fund on a piece of paper, we have that too. We have various named funds in our community, but technically they're all basically assets of Congregation Dor HaDash and under our taxpayer ID number. When we set up our endowment, we set up separate and independent. We amended the bylaws of the community, and we have a separate account at the Jewish Community Foundation through what's called a donor-advised fund. The Jewish Community Foundation can establish donor-advised funds. Donor-advised funds are a way for you as an individual to have your own private foundation. without having all the hassles that come from a foundation of filing returns and being public and everything else. Also, foundations have to make distributions. The donor advised funds do not. So Congregation Dor Hadash has a donor advised fund at the Jewish Community Foundation. It is independent from the synagogue. So if the synagogue were ever sued and went through all our resources, they could not get the endowment because the endowment is held at the community foundation. They could get the John Smith Scholarship Fund, which is a separate fund that we hold for that, or the Mishkan Fund, which is money we've set aside for a building, or any of the other named funds that we have in the community, but they cannot get at the endowment funds.
So you did not roll any of the money in the named funds into the endowment?
We did not. We set up the endowment separately, and we did not touch any of those named, the named fund money, the Mishkan Fund, the Education Fund, or any of the other stuff. We left that as is because that's got greater flexibility.
Okay.
With endowment fund, let me just say, RJ is incorporated in the state of Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania has very restrictive endowment laws, which limit not only what can go into the endowment, but what can come out of the endowment. What can go into the endowment is only if the endowment fund is named. So if you left money to the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College, it would go to the college. If you left money to the endowment fund of the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College, it would go into our endowment. So they're two separate entities. Once in the, if you leave it to the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College, they can spend that money however they see fit. If it goes to the endowment is limited by Pennsylvania state law and can only withdraw up to 7% of the value of the endowment each year. So every state is different. I don't know all the 50 state laws. I unfortunately know California and Pennsylvania because of my role in Pennsylvania, but every state is different. So that's why local resources are really important.
Great. Thank you for that question, Joan. Let's move on. We have a few more questions. Ezra, do you want to go ahead?
Yeah, thank you. This is so interesting and helpful. And I have 1,000 questions, but I'll try and keep it. the non-tangling of money is one thing I wanted to ask about. I mean, our congregation actually has a reasonable reserve. We've never thought of it as an endowment. And I assume that you can't like move between the two. Is that right?
Well, each state is different, but if you argument is, let's suppose you set up an endowment fund and you did it through your community foundation, local community foundation, or your JCF or regular community foundation, and basically transferred the money in there. There is normally in each state between a 3 and a 5 year look back provision, similar to what happens with an individual. So if you're an individual, and you gift money to your kids, and then you file bankruptcy a year later, they can go back and pull those gifts back, saying that it was made within the window. Again, it varies state to state, which is between 3 and 5 years. So it's a 3 to 5 year look back provision. Same thing's true with Medicare or any of the other programs. If you gift money away, there is the look back provision that they can take it back from. After that period expires, that's fine. So as long as your synagogue doesn't go broke, you know, within 5 years of making the gift to the endowment fund, you should be okay. But again, you have to check with state law because state law is predominance.
So that would be a gift to the endowment fund from the congregation.
From the congregation, which is fine. I mean, nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that as long as you know, the congregation gets through that period of gifting.
Okay, but just investing our funds somewhere doesn't turn it into an endowment. We have to create it.
You have to create it. And one of the things we did was with the bylaws is we set up a separate board. We have 3 elected board members that serve 3-year terms, rolling 3-year terms. So each year we're electing one person. The treasurer serves and the president appoints somebody. So it's a 5-member committee. But that way it's separate. And that prevents the board from taking kind of the easy way out when, oops, we're short $20,000 this year. No one wants to ask anybody for money. So why don't we just take it from the endowment? It really prevents that from happening.
Okay. And last question, do you have a goal for like what you think a reasonable endowment for 100, 200 family congregation would be?
No, I mean, I've seen the Orthodox synagogue in town has raised $3 million already. It's crazy. And they only have probably 150 families. So, I mean,
huge.
Yeah, I'm saying that's gigantic. We've got 250,000, and really, it's I consider that great for us. But it's come largely from this one woman's gift and the growth, and then we've had several other bequests of mostly $25,000 at a time, and they've been very modest gifts. I think we've had probably 10 gifts, and the largest one, aside from this lady's the proceeds of the house, which was $85K, was $25,000. I mean, and it just piles up, and it's been invested over time, and, you know, returns have been reasonably good over the last 15 years. I have no idea what they're going to be in the future, but, you know, it's worked out reasonably well. So I think that what we've done, the goals the Community Foundation asked us to set up is how many conversations we're going to have, how many of those conversations are we going to convert to actual people who leave us, who say, yes, I'm going to leave you a bequest. And if we go through the effort of making the plans, putting together the list, having the conversations, they will give us a financial grant for our endowment, of $5,000, which is great. When we started off, they were giving us $12,000 a year for 3 years, but now it's $5,000, and we're going to work on getting that. It just requires having a plan, talking to people, and, you know, reporting the results.
Thank you.
Right. Yeah, thank you, Mark.
Let me just say here, I'm Nina has my address and contact information, and I am very, very happy to talk to anybody and answer any questions, talk to boards, committees, whatever you want me to do, because I so strongly believe in this, in this as our future. So, and there's no such thing as a dumb question. Mm. So be happy to email me or whatever, and I'll be glad to get back to you about all that stuff.
Great. Thank you. Douglas, do you want to go ahead? And
sure. So Mark, I'm retired now, but I was 25 years a gift officer at Michigan and Michigan State. So thanks for taking me down memory lane. I have a different question that's maybe going to take you out of your comfort zone a little bit. I'm in a small congregation and the future is not clear. Now, my experience as a gift officer tells me that if I'm going to ask for an endowed gift, which is forever, I'm asking people to look at my congregation, which might not be here in 10 years. Because that's a big, I don't want to throw, water on the presentation, but I think that's something that's got to be seriously considered as you think about these programs. Are you in an organization that is got the staying power to legitimately ask for that kind of gift? And when at Michigan and both Michigan and Michigan State, there was always a clause in the endowment agreement that said that the board of trustees or whoever would be would do their very best to change the endowment in order to be as close to what the donor had intended. I don't know how you do that in a Jewish community, and I'll just listen to your thoughts. Thanks.
Well, yeah, no, we have ours again with the Jewish Community Foundation of San Diego, so it's a donor advised fund, and our committee basically wrote into the document essentially that if Congregation Dor HaDas ceases to be a viable ongoing entity, the money will be dispersed to the Jewish community to support various activities, and I would assume that it would largely go to Federation.
That could change the gift conversation though pretty soon.
It could change dramatically because people have very strong feelings about Federation, pro and con. I mean, I'm sure we could name, there would be nothing, if we were to get a gift and someone said, I want to leave a Dor HaDas, but I'm worried they're going to be out of business. So I want to make a contingent upon if Dor HaDas is not there, the money goes to fill in the blank, the Jewish day school, the Planned Parenthood, whatever. I have been told by the gift officer at the Jewish Community Foundation that we could write that into the gift. Mm-hmm. Okay. Again, it's not for the $100 donation. It's for something that's, more significant. Again, we've tried to solicit unrestricted gifts, but there is one gift that was made that supports scholarships for the religious school. Mm-hmm. And, so 5% of 25,000, 1,250 covers a kid, through the religious school. you know, that's doable. Now, at the end, if we weren't there, if we didn't have a religious school, I assume that money would go to some other Jewish day school or some other educational activity. But it, I mean, it is a big, it is a concern, and it's, I mean, but you can get around it, I think, by leaving a, you know, if not, if it doesn't, it'll go to, you know, name who you'd like it to go to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you, Mark. So we have one more hand up. I'm glad we can get to it, and then we'll do our wrap up. So Gail, go ahead.
Thanks. I'm with JRC in Evanston. And was a Jewish communal professional in my other life. And so I want to ask more about the donor intent part that we were just talking about. So I'm not sure most people understand the difference between an endowed fund and going straight to the congregation to use as needed, and the fact that their money might be tied up forever and that we're only using the interest on it. Do you have documents that you can share with us that you've used that make it clear what the relationship is and where the gift is going, so that it's clear to the donor, so there's no problems on the back end?
Well, I don't know documents, because we've done is explain to people orally that, you know, we're soliciting money for the endowment. The endowment is a separate entity, and you need to name the endowment fund. We give them the wording. So if you're changing the beneficiary in your IRA, you know, the beneficiary is the endowment fund of Congregation Dor HaDash, care of the Jewish Community Foundation, San Diego, blah, 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 blah. So that it's properly worded in the document. That's separate and distinct. People may just leave it to Congregation Dor HaDash, and then it's up to the board to decide whether they want to use that money for current operating expenses or they want to go to the endowment. If we were in Philadelphia, we would not be able to make that choice, because Pennsylvania has different rules. But in California, at least, the board has the discretion to be able to transfer the money to the endowment with the look-back provision. If, God forbid, something happened to us during a three-year window, California has the ability, bankruptcy court has the ability to reach back to any transfers that were made within 3 years and consider them a transfer in, you know, contemplation of bankruptcy, and therefore, you know, pull that money back out. But as far as gifting it, I mean, it's just explaining. There's nothing written per se that says if you leave the congregation, this is what they can do, and if you leave the endowment, this is what's going to happen. It's just, if it goes to the endowment, it's in a separate fund at the Jewish Community Foundation, and it's separate and distinct money from the congregation's money.
And you don't use a letter of intent? This is our
intent. We have a letter of intent that that we use, that the Jewish Community Foundation has given us. And it's just basically, it's not a contract in any way, shape, or form, right? More informative. And I'm happy to send you the copy of what they give us to use. But it basically just says, I've intended, you know, I've named XYZ in my estate plans, and you should expect to receive fill in the blank. You know, my car, my apartment, a 10% interest in my endowment. I mean, it's very wide open.
Would love
to see. I will be sending out a template with the recording. I'll be sending out a template for a form that you can use for people that want to, you know, have an intent, and then when they've made the commitment. So they're modeled on the Grinspoon forms, but I've modified them slightly for our purposes. So those will be going out as
perfect,
well.
Nina. And I can also give you, Nina, I can also send you all the stuff that we got from the Jew. They've given me permission to share anything I want to share with you, with everybody.
Yeah, so we will be sending that out. I do not see any more hands up, which is wonderful, because we have about 4 minutes left. I wanted to just ask Mark if he has any closing thoughts. I did also want to mention that I put in the chat the invitation to our next leadership call. So if you want to, particularly if you are a president and you want to register for that, you can go ahead and do that now. And so Mark, any closing
thoughts?
All I'd
say to you is that you shouldn't be afraid to get started. Even if you just pick one person in your community to have the conversation with, I think you'll find it very energizing. I know I was very apprehensive having the very first conversation I had with somebody about making a legacy gift. But when you have the conversation and you get them talking about what they love about the community and what they would love to see happen in the future, what they're worried about the future, because all of us have worries about the future, it really is a very satisfying conversation to have. And you come away with basically their promise to do something about it. And not necessarily a specific amount of money, not necessarily a specific action, but a really a commitment to do something and to know that the community is going to be remembered. And it really feels good. And I think all of us need in this day and age something that we can feel really good about.
Absolutely true. I just wanted to say that I am a member of the Thriving Communities team. I was executive director of a congregation. We were part of a life and legacy cohort, so I have a lot of experience doing this. We were very successful. So if anyone wants to reach out to me, I'm happy to have a one-on-one conversation with you about getting started with plan giving, or if you feel like you're stuck, happy to have that conversation. Tressa, is there anything that you'd like to add before we close?
Just that I thought it was great. And if you couldn't feel Mark's enthusiasm through the screen, you know that he is incredibly generous with his time and resources. So take him up on his offer as well for help and support. So thank you so much,
Mark. Feel free to reach out to me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark. And feel free to reach out to me for Mark's contact information. I'm happy to provide that as well. Thank you, everyone, for being with us today.
Great. Thanks.
All right.